you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
You want answers? I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Someone is trying to teach me a lesson in futility. Why am I the only one who isn't killed?
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, sir, yeah.
Plastics.
I'm going to get your money for you. But if you don't get the President of the United States on that phone, you know what's going to happen to you?
What?
You're going to have to answer to the Coca-Cola company.
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to have Dr. Kevin Barrett on the show. Dr. Barrett is a PhD Arabist Islamologist. He's the host of Truth Jihad Radio and the co-host of False Flag Weekly News. Dr. Barrett has taught at colleges and universities in San Francisco, Paris, and Wisconsin, where he ran for the U.S. Congress in 2008. Dr. Barrett, how are you doing this evening?
I'm well. Good to be with you.
Well, thanks for coming on the show. Well, the reason why, well, first of all, you began as what you call kind of a truther researcher regarding the 9/11 events. This was.
Well, yeah, that's kind of the career track I'm on now, although I actually really began more as a scholar of writing. I got a journalism bachelor's degree, and then I got 3 master's degrees and a PhD in different languages and literatures with a focus on literature. PhD was actually on Islam and Sufi storytelling in Morocco. So I got sidetracked onto 9/11 because in late 2003, I woke up to the fact that there was a problem with that, a major problem. I heard about David Ray Griffin doing some research and discovering that they'd blown up the trade towers and they had done something at the Pentagon that wasn't just a hijacking. So I looked into it, discovered it was true, and felt obliged to try to do something about it. So I got into doing teach-ins at the University of Wisconsin, and then I got nominated as the scapegoat for Scholars for 9/11 Truth in 2006, which knocked me out of the academy and into the alternative media community, and so I've been there ever since.
So you were expelled from academia for just bringing up questions regarding the events of 9/11, at least the official narrative.
Pretty much. Yeah. I wouldn't have been, except they just happened to decide to use me as the guy they were going to try to scare off all the other professors by, you know, throwing mud at me on Fox News. And so I ended up being, you know, so encumbered by what you'll find when you Google me that nobody could hire me because they would lose all kinds of money. The University of Wisconsin lost $500,000 overnight when I was on Hannity and Combs the first time. And so all universities know this. So they, you know, they know if they hire me, they'll have a scandal on their hands. And so there's no way they ever will.
So universities are concerned with money, not truth and scholarship. And
yeah, that's a shocker, isn't it?
Well, okay. So tonight, well, you recently had a conference a video conference that I watched and listened to a couple times, and it was Zionism Deconstructing the Power Paradigm, and you had Philip Giraldi, Giad Altman, Alan Sobrowski, and Jeremy Roth Kreshel. They all have different segments, and you talked about, aspects of Zionism and Jewish power and what it means for the United States and the world. And your selection was, at least your part, was anti-Semitism and Judeophobia. Let's define the terms. So that was your part of it. So let's you define the terms tonight for our listeners.
Well, the term anti-Semitism is thrown around a lot. It's one of the most damaging things that you can call anybody, right up there with Holocaust denier. And the term anti-Semite, like the term Holocaust denier, essentially implies that the person being so described is a racist. The term anti-Semite implies this because Semite is a racial category, or at least it used to be. Back in the 19th century, the linguists discovered that there were these affinities between languages. So Arabic and Hebrew and Aramaic and so on were Semitic languages. And so they just assumed that people that came from background speaking these languages were members of a race, the Semitic race. So that's how the term Semitism and anti-Semitism came to be identified with prejudice against Jewish people. I think the kind of early to mid 19th century, the notion of anti-Semite was first used, and then it got taken up later in the century as a term of opprobrium for Jew haters. And so this notion that anybody who criticizes Israel or Jewish power or disagrees vociferously with this or that aspect of the Jewish religion or some particular interpretation of the Jewish religion is a racist, is what's implied by the term anti-Semite. But there's some truth to this, I suppose, in that there are racists around, and there are some people who start imagining negative racial characteristics that they apply to Jews. But that's very, very marginal. There are very few people doing that, and those people have no influence or power at all. So those who are actually critiquing Zionism, the Jewish religion, State of Israel, Jewish power in America, and so on, are mostly doing it from a non-racist perspective. They're critiquing culture or politics, but they still get called anti-Semites, and the implication is that they're racists, and since being a racist is so horrible, especially being a racist against Jews is so horrible after what Hitler did, such people then have their lives and careers ruined when they're insulted in this misleading way. So I argued in this presentation that we should not be using the term anti-Semite because today it's irrelevant. Hardly anybody imagines that there's some sort of racial issue with Jews. And so instead we should talk about Judeophobia, which would be any kind of prejudice against Jews. That is something sort of irrational or excessive in people's negative attitudes towards Jews. That could be labeled Judeophobia. And so I'm just, saying that we should be using language that accurately describes the reality that we're trying to describe. And I don't really see how that's likely to get us banned from YouTube for saying that, but you never know these days.
So, the criticism of Jews, I think it's someone's joke that one time an anti-Semite was someone who disliked Jews. Now it's someone who's disliked by Jews.
That's absolutely right. It's a joke, but it's all too true.
Yeah. And just the mere criticism of the Israeli government or the Mossad or Israeli machinations or Jewish influence. And there are Jewish organizations. There is Jewish agency, and they do operate, they coordinate, and they have a significant impact on foreign policy of the United States. And so you would think just by virtue of their prominence and their influence that they should be open to criticism, because that's how you maintain some semblance of accountability and balance in any society aspiring to be free.
Yeah, of course. And it's very taboo now to talk about the Jewish lobby, although throughout history, people all over the world, in France, for example, have talked about the lobby juif, the Jewish lobby in the United States. Just like we would talk about the Cuban lobby, hating Castro. We had all sorts of anti-Castro Cubans in the United States with a big political footprint, and we called it the Cuban lobby. And likewise, there is what one might call a Jewish lobby. There is the group, I forget, there's like 50, 60 of the leading Jewish organizations that actually have an umbrella group. So they're really all organized. And these are the leading Jewish organizations. And every single one of them is very pro-Israel, to the extent of, you know, they might as well just be part of the Israeli government. So this is a pretty extraordinary situation. This lobby is vastly more powerful and more nefarious in terms of steering U.S. policy in a very destructive and murderous direction than the Cuban lobby ever was, or any other sort of ethnic lobbies ever were. So I think it's okay to talk about a Jewish lobby. Of course, we do want to make sure that we're not misunderstood. We're not talking about a racial group that's bad because of racial characteristics or anything like that. We're just talking about an ethnic or tribal group that bands together on a sort of nationalistic basis, and they have their settler colony over in occupied Palestine, where they're committing slow motion genocide against the Palestinians. This is the reality, and we should be able to describe that reality accurately.
Yes, yes. Now, Jewish power, they often, Jews themselves will brag about it. Alan Dershowitz has said that Jews shouldn't be afraid of admitting they have power and exercising that power. I think it was Neil Gabel who wrote a book, Empire of Their Own, about how Jews through Hollywood shaped American culture. And also you have the famous, you know, Joel Stein, and I think it was the Los Angeles Times, talked about Jews control Hollywood, and we shouldn't be afraid to admit that or embarrassed, but that they should try to keep control of Hollywood. So you have a situation where Jewish power is acknowledged by many, you know, well-known, famous Jews themselves, but if a Gentile acknowledges Jewish power, that's considered anti-Semitic.
That's right. And that actually is a kind of prejudice. If we want to be unprejudiced, we should try to clear our minds of prejudgments. And it's not the people who talk freely and openly and frankly about Jewish power who are the prejudiced ones. At least maybe a few of them are, but most are not. People like Alan Zabrowski are not prejudiced. He's Jewish himself. Mm-hmm. People like Jeremy Rothkuchel are not prejudiced. He's Jewish himself. And so on and so forth.
It's interesting to say that, yeah, during your conference, you had three Jews in that conference, right?
That's right. Yeah. So it's kind of weird if they're going to try and call it anti-Semitic, but or whatever. It should be Judeophobic. In any case, the prejudiced people are the people who have this prejudgment that any frank discussion about Jews or Jewish power or Jewish identity politics is automatically taboo, racist, unacceptable, a negative thing, should be banned, should be stopped. This is a kind of a gut reaction that a lot of people have, both Jewish people and the fair number of non-Jewish people who've been indoctrinated. And that's prejudice. So these are the people who are prejudiced, and they're the ones who should be called out for their prejudice. And frankly, if we were going to be, you know, censoring or banning or you know, giving wrist slaps to anybody, it should be those people. It should be the people who are actually prejudiced, not the unprejudiced people like Jeremy and others.
Yeah, and there is a well-known history of sort of, you could say, Jewish intrigues. One thing is getting America on board the Zionist cause, particularly right around World War One, and facilitating America's entry into World War One. The backstory to that is the Jewish intrigue. This is like Samuel Untermeyer, Bernard Baruch, and working with the British, and this was the Rothschild Balfour Project, and this was Louis Brandeis, who was the first Jewish Supreme Court Justice. And he himself, although he renounced his officially renounced his membership in like I believe it was the B'nai B'rith, but then he maintained membership in this Parushim, the Jewish Secret Society. He worked behind the scenes to intrigue America into the war, to help fulfill the promises of the Balfour Declaration, something that came to fruition after World War II, of course. So we have examples of this, right, throughout history of sort of Jewish intrigue in American foreign policy, flexing its muscle. But then if you point it out, then you're cited as being anti-Semitic and, you know, you're a Nazi or something.
Right. And so the people who are calling names whenever anyone speaks honestly and openly about these things are really the prejudiced ones, because they're the ones who are exercising kind of emotional prejudgment against somebody. And they're actually the persecutors. You know, I do identify with those who don't want Jews to be persecuted or don't want anybody to be persecuted. Yeah. You know, political correctness may be running amok these days, but there's a kernel of goodness to political correctness, which is this notion that we shouldn't persecute people, that persecuted victims tend to be innocent. René Girard is the great thinker who really alerts us to this. And throughout history, of course, Jews have been both persecutors and persecuted. And today we happen to live in a culture that has essentially been taken over by this dogma that Jews as a kind of an ethnic group that works to a certain extent tribally to try to achieve nationalistic or tribal objectives, that they are always the persecuted and never the persecutors. And this is absurd. Look at Palestine. This Jewish nationalism, or Zionism, which is a very extreme messianic form of Jewish nationalism, it's committing genocide over in Palestine. Obviously, the Palestinians are the victims, and the self-proclaimed Jewish state is the persecutor. But the prejudice that we're forced to kowtow to here would have it the other way around. The prejudice tells us that Jews are always innocent victims, and that whoever Jews are having a problem with must be the persecutor. Now, that's prejudice. That's bigotry. That's, you could call it anti-Goy prejudice, you call it anti-Goyism, make up some terrible name and inflict it on these people. But the reality of the situation is that that's the real prejudice today. And and so those people who have that sort of, I wouldn't call it philo-Semitism, you know, that's the old word for being sort of pro-Jewish. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that's the right word for it. I think that I'm not even sure what the right word for it is, but it's whatever the problem of bigotry and prejudice today operates. The real bigotry and prejudice is much more pro-Jewish than anti-Jewish, and that's the reality. And there's a reaction to that, and off in the far marginal corners of the internet, you can find these, you know, stormtrooper.com places where they really do hate Jews, and they would love to go out and persecute Jews if they had the power to, but they don't, so they end up being the ones that get persecuted too. So obviously, overall here, in terms of persecutor versus persecutee, overall, the Jewish tribalist nationalistic forces are the persecutors everywhere. I mean, even the Nazis are being persecuted by the Jews today. It's kind of hilarious and in a dark and twisted way, but that's the reality. Now, certainly that wasn't the reality in 1930s Germany. It was the opposite. But today we have... yeah, what are we going to call it? Jewish Nazism or, you know, Zionism, this insane extremist millenarianism that's all, you know, it's this distorted heretical spinoff of normal Judaism that says that if we invade and Palestine and all the Jews go back to Palestine before God told it, before God put us there, the real Judaism says Jews only go to Palestine when God does it himself. No Jew is ever supposed to lift a finger to try to get the Jews back to Palestine. But then along comes the satanic spinoff of Judaism, which is called Zionism, which was created by Shabtai Zvi, the false messiah, whose career culminated in the year 1666. And he starts this process of satanic Zionism, which says, rebel against God. You know, Satan is the guy who rebels against God and persecutes and commits genocide. And so they follow the model of Satan. They say, let's go to invade the Holy Land. Let's go there. We're going to commit abominations. And Shabtai Zvi taught his followers to ritually commit abominations, human sacrifices, sexual abominations, and so on. This was taken up by his Kabbalistic follower, Jacob Frank. This is the black heart of Zionism that, you know, and not all Zionists, of course, know this, but almost all Zionists are consciously, or in most cases unconsciously, acting out a satanic persecutor role. That is, they identify with Satan. The word Satan means the adversarial prosecutor or persecutor. Satan is the persecutor of the innocent. And that's what Zionists have become today. And they're fanatically dedicated to persecuting the Palestinians, who are completely innocent. They just lived there. They're just living in the Holy Land. That was their crime. And for that crime, they're being exterminated. Children are being shot down on sidewalks and schoolyards. White phosphorus is being dropped on schools and hospitals and UN installations. And most Israeli Jews approve of all this. 95%+ of Israeli Jews approved of Cast Lead and all these follow-up mowing the lawn operations in Gaza, these relentless ongoing mass massacres that the Zionists commit every couple of years. So obviously Satan, the symbol of the persecutor, is the real God of Israel. And the extremist Zionists kind of know this because they're planning to tear down the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is dedicated to God, and they're going to put up a blood sacrifice temple. That's the extreme endgame of the millenarian satanic spin-off from Judaism known as Zionism.
Obviously, the list of horribles that you just provided there is a firm basis for at least some skepticism towards the Zionist project, the Israeli state, and also Jewish power and how it's flexed here in the United States, because the United States, because of Jewish influence, has become complicit in the crimes of the Israeli state. You have Benjamin Netanyahu receiving 29 standing ovations when he comes and speaks before Congress. Congress itself is pretty much a wholly owned subsidiary of AIPAC, which is an agent of the Israeli government, yet still doesn't have to register as a foreign agent under the Foreign Agency Registration Act. But this is sound reason to be critical of these things. And this has obviously created a lot of criticism and bad feelings among many Americans towards the Israeli government, also Jewish power in general, which is real. And you also have the geopolitical national security issues, the Jewish intriguing, and also the espionage involved in here that pops up every so often here in the States. There's also the cultural angle, where Jews use their influence in the culture industry to be subversive. You could say that's one of the things that maybe pointed out in Hollywood and in music and these things. And there were advocates of abortion and pornography back in the 20th century, fundamentally changed our culture. And this was part of an agenda, because you can trace this back at least to the American Jewish Committee and the authoritarian personality. But it was implemented in the 1960s, largely through Hollywood and the music industry and these things. The idea of you promote sexual degenerate behavior for the purposes of weakening the family and particularly undermining the role of the father. And you, that way you lead to an atomized, divided society, which as an alien group, they often feel gets more secure in, because according to the authoritarian personality, it was the strong father figure and family which was the source of the fascism. And if they weaken those institutions, they'd be stronger. And that's, to me, again, that's basically, it was a declaration of ethnic warfare against the majority of Americans, particularly Catholic Americans.
I think there's something to that.
Yeah.
Of course, the guy to talk to about that is over at Culture Wars magazine. E. Michael Jones. He's done a very interesting scholarship on this kind of Catholic versus Jewish struggle for power in America in the cultural sphere. I think there's a lot to that. However, I don't think it's entirely that simple. Like, I do think Jews were overrepresented in, of course, the Frankfurt School. In fact, massively overrepresented in that, but in so many other intellectual movements as well. But the cultural shifts that came about post World War II, I think, were not just a sort of Jewish conspiracy or anything like that. I think there was a whole sort of generational thing in which the so-called Greatest Generation, which I don't think was quite that great. They supposedly won World War II. No, they didn't. The Russians won World War II. And they beat the evil Hitler. Well, yeah, Hitler wasn't too great, but what the Allies did in World War II wasn't too great either. In fact, they may have actually eclipsed Hitler's war crimes, with more than 10 million innocent Germans being exterminated under the occupation, according to some of the very challenging scholarship that's been done in the past couple of decades. Not even getting into the firebombings of German cities, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and so on and so forth. Eisenhower killing a million German POWs by locking them behind barbed wire with no heavy clothing or shelter, letting them just starve and freeze to death. I mean, the atrocities against Germany were just off the charts, and it's always possible that the charges against Hitler may have been slightly exaggerated in order to cover for that. But in any case, the Greatest Generation certainly was not all that great. But they came back from World War II scarred and battered. They knew they'd committed horrific war crimes, you know, the rapes off the charts, you know, these atrocities against Germans that they were part of, and Japanese, even worse in some ways. These people came back, and, you know, they never could talk about it. This strong, silent World War II vet was the stereotype, and my uncle was like that. Mm-hmm. And so they were pretty patriarchal. They came back, they got married. And then they raised the generation of baby boomers, and the baby boomers rebelled against that. And it was, you know, maybe Jews were overrepresented in this sort of cultural rebellion of baby boomers who came of age at the time that the pill showed up and rock and roll went ballistic. But I don't think this was really even mainly a Jewish thing. I think it was a sort of a generational thing. And so, and there were pluses and minuses, right? That is, again, that Greatest Generation was pretty hypocritical and authoritarian in certain ways. They were murderers in World War II, and so they came back, and a lot of them were still murderers afterwards. What they did to Korea was just grotesque. You know, talk about a Holocaust, like 4 million Koreans slaughtered, massive biological weapons spread all over North Korea. Every city, every town, even villages, just utterly destroyed by bombing. The only survivors were huddled in caves. That was a total Holocaust. And these killers, these World War II Greatest Generation killers, they killed the Kennedys. You know, they brought Nazis over here and worked happily with them. So they were pretty, you know, and then they perpetrated a Holocaust in Vietnam, and then the baby boomers rebelled against that. And Jews were overrepresented among these baby boomers rebelling against the genocide in Vietnam. But hey, that's to their credit. You know, I mean, Abbie Hoffman is still in some ways a hero of mine. He made activism and doing the right thing and speaking truth to power fun. So there was that side of it all, too. It's a very complex picture. We don't want to oversimplify. But there is a particular analysis, if you do a very sort of broad scale analysis, looking down at it from a distance over the spread of the 20th century, like E. Michael Jones does, then, yeah, you see a sort of a struggle between Catholics and Jews, and the Jews tend to be on the side of the sort of cultural radicals. I would argue that's not always bad. The anti-Vietnam War movement was good, and Nixon was right when he screamed and yelled about the Jews being behind it and the Jews in the media are making it hard to do Vietnam. Well, that was to the credit of the Jews in the media. I mean, they're not always bad. So the reality is very complex and multifaceted. But post 9/11, I think Jewish power starts getting, you know, as malevolent as the so-called Greatest Generation's power was post-World War II. I mean, now Zionist power has become that same killer that has murdered 32 million Muslims around the world since 9/11. Again, that's a mega Holocaust. Gideon Paglia is my source for those numbers. And this is really all about using American power to smash Israel's enemies on behalf of expansionists like Kudnik Zionism. And talking about this is really sensitive. The B'nai B'rith hates this, and the reason they hate it is they know it's true, and they know that if people discover that it's true, their power is finished. So no wonder they're freaking out about it.
Yeah. That's true. A lot of it is these are complex things, but you know, the Jewish promotion of degenerate behavior, you know, predates the Holocaust. So the American Jewish Committee tended to blame it on Hitler, but you know, you had. You know, this was being promoted back in the 20s and 30s, Wilhelm Reich and these things. So it predates this thing. So there's a, E. Michael Jones.
Wait. See, Reich was this, you know, extremist sort of sexual libertarian coming out of psychoanalysis. But who was the big name in psychoanalysis?
Freud.
Sigmund Freud. And was Freud a crazed libertarian? Not at all. Freud was all in favor of superego and repression and civilization. Freud was a pretty conservative thinker, really. And so, again,
didn't he see himself as a, you know, a latter day, you know, who, you know, what's his name? The Carthaginian general. You know.
Right.
What's his name?
Yeah, I mean.
Assaulting Rome.
Well, okay, but yeah. See, he's. Yeah. But Hannibal. But
Hannibal. He saw himself assaulting Rome and assaulting Christian civilization with psychoanalysis. And Michael E. Michael Jones would say this was part of that revolutionary spirit reverberating throughout history. The rejection of logos. This gets into the Christian interpretation of it. But the idea is their dedicated idea of reforming the world to Kun Olam, and that's they see themselves as being revolutionary, and this sort of pervades the culture, and this is why they're so big in supporting. They'll call it reform. Another person will say, "Well, this is subversion." Amy Dean can go right into Kun magazine and saying it's the Jews that created gay marriage in the country. But if E. Michael Jones says he's being anti-Semitic, but if Amy Dean says he's Jewish, then here we go, we get that double standard again. So they're promoting this radicalism under the name of reform. So there is a legitimate question or problem with. I mean, there's no problem pointing at some problems with, Christians, and their attitude towards things, they love doing the culture critique and analyzing the problems in general Christian culture, particularly, the born-again Christians and these things and the culture it creates. Well, there's a general liberal, I think, permissive culture in Jewish culture. They tend to support radical subversive causes, which are an affront to the, tradition or normal society. And they'll do things like ensconce people in the courts and these things to provide the proper judicial decisions and the bureaucracies and these things. And so I think there's a legitimate criticism here of a certain outlook, which it tends to support a subversive undermining the traditional or established culture.
Yeah, I think there's some truth to that. But I don't really share E. Michael Jones's complete blanket condemnation of what he calls the Jewish revolutionary spirit. Again, I would take a more nuanced view. I think that's true that Jews have been outsiders in Christian culture. And as outsiders, they have been kind of subversive in various ways, including through a culture of critique. But I don't think a culture of critique is all bad. I
mean, but isn't turnabout fair play, though?
What we're supposed to do in the academy.
That's true. Nothing wrong with critique. But they're all for critique when they're critiquing somebody else. When you critique them, they want to pass hate speech laws and shut you down and deny funding. In the 1950s, I think it was Ginsburg's book, The Fatal Embrace, he talks about in the 1950s, the Jewish organizations, this is the critical period right after Israel was founded, that there is a lot of criticism in the American media about this, particularly U.S. support for it. And they practiced what they called dynamic silence. And this was they flexed Jewish financial muscle to silently boycott those voices in the media that were critiquing the policy. And what happened is these people simply lost their... One example was Dorothy Thompson, who's this trailblazing female journalist, had a nationally syndicated radio show, a column and these things. And she was very critical of the Third Reich during the Second World War. But right after Israel was founded in the late 40s and 50s, she was very critical of what was going on in Palestine, the clearing out, the genocide that was going on there. And she just simply lost her career, goes down the memory hole. And when you have that type of intrigue going on behind the scenes, you're going to create all types of conspiracy theory, because indeed there was a conspiracy to shut people up.
I think the problem that you're identifying is not just one of too much critique coming from Jews at the Christian civilization, but it's also, perhaps more importantly, a lack of critique towards excesses of, in this case, Jewish nationalism or other Jewish tribal projects. So it's essentially a kind of unbalance, or it's a tendency towards ethnocentrism, really. And let's be honest about the fact that ethnocentrism is far from a Jewish monopoly.
No.
All sorts of groups are ethnocentric one way or another. So that what I was getting at with my claim that this critique that has been a kind of a tradition in this so-called Jewish revolutionary spirit that E. Michael Jones talks about has a good side and a bad side. That is, it's I think that critiquing institutions of power is generally very useful. Critiquing and exposing truth when it's been covered up is great. I mean, that's basically what I try to do. And I think that there are many people coming out of this Jewish tradition that do that. I see Jeremy Roth Kushel as doing that, for example. In a sense, I see Jeremy Roth Kushel as an embodiment of the Jewish prophetic spirit, which is just the prophetic. It's the same prophetic spirit that brought us Jesus and Muhammad, too. And this is a spirit of speaking truth to power and being willing to suffer exclusion and scapegoating and all sorts of punishment from power for having guts to stand up and expose it. And that is something that I think has been done disproportionately by people coming out of the Jewish community too, along with all these other ethnocentric things. So actually, I would, you know, I would go against E. Michael Jones. At the end of the day, I would be on the opposite side of the table from him. I would say that the problem that we're identifying in the behavior of Jewish communities through history, and that's, of course, what Laurent Guyot's magisterial book From Yahweh to Zion is really all about. It's looking at this thing all the way back from the beginning. These problems are, to my mind, not so much about revolutionary spirit and tearing conventional values and traditional institutions and all that kind of stuff that Kevin MacDonald and E. Michael Jones go on about. It's more actually the opposite. It's hiding the truth on behalf of power and contributing to the mythologies and obfuscations and conventional lies that prop up power. So for me, the real problem in the Jewish community and other communities as well is this problem of there's a guy who we were trying to get to contribute to our 9/11 and Empire Volume 2. I'm blanking out on his name, but he's identified with talking about prophetic Judaism versus Constantinian Judaism. And Constantinian Judaism is like Constantinian Christianity, was when the Christian church, which was a totally subversive force in ancient Rome, suddenly took over as the church of the empire. And likewise, within Judaism, there's a conflict between the prophetic tradition of speaking truth to power and then this tradition of establishing power and trying to silence the
Carroll?
Prophets. The guy I'm thinking of is they ginned up some scandal about him and one of his students and tried to silence him. And so nobody's been talking about this guy for a decade now. And I'm totally forgetting his name, but maybe I'll pull it up later. But anyway, Constantinian Judaism is the problem. So I don't think Freud is the problem. I think Freud, yeah, sure, he was kind of critiquing Christian civilization. What he was really critiquing was what he thought was he was tearing down these lies that we tell ourselves and that get institutionalized in our own minds and hide the truth of our own deepest thoughts from ourselves. So he was actually more on the side of trying to reveal the truth, I think. But I do think that I don't think he was completely right about it. I think that the problem is people like the neoconservatives, not the radical Jews like Marx and Freud. I think Marx and Freud had a little bit of the truth and spoke some of it to power. But I think that the neoconservatives are classic examples of Constantinian Judaism. That is, these people from the Jewish community who essentially they become atheists, the neocons anyway, and they say, you know, sure, you know, this is all mythology that's used to control the masses, but you know the happy man is the man who is he looks good on the outside, but he's evil on the inside, and that way he gets the best of both worlds. He can steal and cheat and rape and pillage and get away with it, and everybody thinks he's noble and good and honest, and so people think highly of him. Plus, he gets all the goodies from raping, pillaging, and so on. So that, I mean, that's basically this very, very cynical kind of philosophy that Leo Strauss used rereading Plato. And that's the neocons use this way of seeing things, plus a little bit of Nietzsche thrown in of neo-paganism and being the strong Superman who can see through all the BS of the, you know, Christians shepherding the masses and stuff. So these neocons have joined up with power. And so this is like the Book of Esther is their template. You know, Esther joins up with the power of the Persian throne to slaughter the enemies of the Jews. Now, that's not speaking truth to power. What that's doing is joining up with power, in this case, the Persian king, and slaughtering your enemies and getting more power for yourself and your tribe. That is Constantinian Judaism, and that is evil. But the side of Judaism that is the revolutionary spirit is that's Jesus. That's speaking truth to power. And Freud and Marx were trying to do a little bit of that in their own demented ways. But, you know, they're more on that side than they are on the Constantinian side. So this is the way I see it. So I would definitely not totally agree with Jones and Kevin MacDonald on this, although I think that a lot of what they say is accurate. But I think that their prejudice against this, you know, these sort of critiques that break down traditions, which I understand. Our traditions have fallen away and have been broken down, and it's very disturbing, and I can understand why they feel that way. But I think that's distorted their reading of the Jewish religious past, and they're blind to the fact that a lot of this revolutionary spirit is actually the prophetic spirit.
Now, you mentioned the neoconservatives. I always thought it was very interesting that, you mentioned, the neocon godfather. You just said his name.
Leo Strauss.
Leo Strauss, yeah, Leo Strauss out of Chicago. He was the protege of Carl Schmitt, who was a Nazi legal theorist. And he had this weird alliance between Zionism and Nazism, of course, because they both, they kind of worked together because they both had the same objective.
Well, they're mirror images of each other. They're extreme millenarian kind of racist nationalisms.
Yeah, and it's even like it was, there was Otto Skorzeny was advising the Israelis on how to organize the security force and after the Second World War and these things. So a lot of weird stories like that, and not to mention the fact sort of how even in the post-war national security state, you had a lot of former Nazis and Jews coming over into the United States and these things. But the rise of the neocon, I think when you had Alan Sobrowski, he talked about how they went from influence to dominance in his talk. The Jewish influence, and he pointed out in 1956 when President Eisenhower told the British, the French, and Israelis to cease and desist the Suez thing, and they had to at that time. And at the time, he tells a story where he had an Israeli ambassador speak at his class back in the 80s, said they could only get into two congressional offices at the time to talk about this, and so they had no influence, very little influence, although I'd say the fact the Israeli state existed proved that they have a lot of influence. But as far as they didn't control Congress yet. And he said by the 80s, now they had pretty much had controlled every representative on Capitol Hill, pretty much. And so that's how did this happen? Well, you have Suez Crisis. Then there's more. Then I think there's the determination that they need to get control of the domestic political situation in the United States so they can use the United States as muscle. And so you have, one thing you have, some people think that key factor in this was the assassination of John F. Kennedy in 1963. They've connected the Israelis to that as being at least partly involved in it. And then you, of course...
Yeah, absolutely. Lauren Guyonneau covers that brilliantly in his book, From Yahweh to Zion.
And the 67, the Six-Day War, then you sort of have a coming out of Jewish power in the United States. This also coincides sort of with the coming to the end of the WASP elite. And then after the 1970s, you have the death of Nelson Rockefeller, and sort of the coming of age of Jewish power in the United States, and the neoconservative takeover, particularly of the Reagan administration. And you point out a lot of the people like Paul Wolfowitz, at one point lost his security clearance because he was passing classified information to Israelis. Yet he was able to come back in government and become Assistant Secretary of Defense under George W. Bush. Shows the power there. I think the same thing applies to, the Prince of Darkness, what's his name?
Richard Pearl,
right? I think he was caught too. He lost his security clearance for these things.
Yeah, so, a whole bunch of them. Clark, supposedly, he actually became ineligible for, I forget which job it was, so they kicked him upstairs to become, first he was on the National Security Council, and Gwyneth Todd talks about serving next to him and what a scumbag he is and how she thinks he was the ringleader of 9/11. He was this terror czar then under the end of Clinton's administration and the beginning of Bush's. He carried over. So the guy, think about it, the guy who's the terror czar and makes the transition between Clinton's administration and Bush's in the run-up to 9/11, that is pretty a suspicious position to be in. And especially if Gwyneth is right and he was an Israeli agent and outed as an Israeli agent.
Well, isn't it now almost they sort of admit it and... I mean, you have the dual citizenship issue, right? And you have the dual loyalty issue. But, it was Rahm Emanuel, right? His father was He was the
He served in the IDF. Emanuel never served in America's armed forces. He was in the IDF. And, of course, he was being trained to be a Mossad, a high-level Mossad handler of American politics. Mm-hmm. He claims he was, I forget, he has this ridiculous cover story of what he did during his couple of years of service in the IDF.
Was he a medic or something?
Yeah, but obviously he was being trained, and he came back, and you know, he's the guy that Obama was forced to appoint as chief of staff. And when they asked Obama, wait a minute, you wanted to close Guantanamo, you wanted to end the wars, and then you appointed Rahm Emanuel as your chief of staff, and he torpedoed all of that. Why did you appoint him? And Obama said, well, we owed some people.
Then he's illegally elected mayor of Chicago. Then he's illegally elected mayor of Chicago.
Yeah. So there is a sense in which the U.S. is Israeli occupied territory. It's so, really getting to that point.
Yeah, I mean, the examples are just ridiculous. You can point out so many examples of these things. And who was the guy, the head of National, Chertoff, Michael Chertoff, another one, a dual citizen who helped cover it up. And they hustled the bin Ladens out of the country, and also the Israelis that were caught on 9/11. They covered that up.
The dancing Israelis who were caught celebrating the destruction of the Twin Towers.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So the source of this power, I think... Giraldi covered this a lot. The groups, the presidents of the Jewish organizations, they coordinate, aggregate their power, and there's a whole bunch of satellite organizations that coordinate the policy. So they can bribe and blackmail enough politicians to get their policy through. But the idea is, what explains this much control? I mean, how does the dog wag the tail wag the dog in this relationship?
Well, I think the best way to understand it is through a reading of history.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I recommend Guglielmo's book for the full story. I mean, it really covers the whole mm-hmm. history. I don't think it's a complete kind of history. That is, I think it's looking at things from a particular perspective, which is not entirely my perspective, but it's a really, really good historical critique of this tendency in Jewish communities going back to the formation of the earliest Jewish communities for these cognitive elites, originally a Yahwist priesthood, and then later on rabbinical elites that married their smartest sons with the daughters of the wealthiest bankers and business people, creating a caste of very sharp folks, kind of a cognitive elite, which continued to manipulate tribal solidarity to enhance their own intergenerational wealth and power. And that's been going on for thousands of years. So that's the big picture. And then if we want to talk about, well, how did this happen to the United States, we have to look at U.S. history. And again, Lauren Guyonneau does that, looking at the establishment of the Federal Reserve, the orchestration of World Wars I and II, and then in the aftermath of World War II, the buildup to the kind of total control we have now, as, again, the Kennedy assassination being a key moment. Johnson, according to Guyonneau, was very likely from crypto-Jewish origins. Guyonneau's book goes into the importance of this crypto-Jewish thing. When the Muranos were expelled from Portugal and Spain, they went all over the world and became the leading sort of transatlantic traders, and indeed global traders. And so they had a big piece of the action in the triangle trade, the slave, rum, sugar trade between Europe and the Americas, as well as got their fingers in a lot of other pies of trade as well. And so there is this kind of global elite that does have a kind of an ethnic solidarity, and some of them more than others. There are people from sort of vaguely crypto-Jewish backgrounds who barely even notice it. But Johnson apparently did notice it and was proud of it. And it's, you know, Jewish magazines wrote about Johnson as the first Jewish president and things like that. He certainly was a total ally or slave or agent of Israel from the get-go. And it was very convenient for Israel that JFK, who was dedicated to shutting down Israel's nuclear program, suddenly got knocked off, putting Israel's man Johnson in the White House. Johnson proceeded to preside over the theft and transfer of American nuclear materials to Israel, as well as the 1967 War of Aggression, when Israel stole the heart of the Holy Land. and got away with it. And indeed, Johnson conspired with the Israelis to slaughter, they were trying to slaughter the entire crew of the USS Liberty, which would have been almost 300 people. But by a miracle, the crew got off that message saying their attackers were Israelis, not Egyptians or whatever, and they had to call it off. But the purpose of that was to try, it was Johnson and the Israelis conspiring to try to bring the U.S. into the 1967 war. Johnson wanted to be able to pummel the Russians who had married in Egypt. And indeed, according to the book, this what's it called, Cyanide, the Operation Cyanide by Peter Hunnam, nuclear-armed American bombers were actually launched and were just minutes away from the point of no return when they were called back because the Liberty got that message out. And so the purpose of the Liberty had been to give Johnson the opportunity to drop nuclear weapons on Russian installations in Egypt, among other things. And so this whole history is one of the this Zionist lobby in the United States going from originally being this lobby that had to register as a lobby of you know, for agents of a foreign power, which is very inconvenient and exposes them, to then calling themselves just a sort of a political lobby, a domestic political lobby with no foreign connections, which is a complete joke, but they got away with that transformation around 1960. And then they just started organizing and putting their people in. And I'm sure that blackmail has been a big part of this. You know, it was very interesting that the last presidential election was between the wife of a guy who was a regular flyer on Jeffrey Epstein's Lolita Express airline, which is a bunch of, you know, pedophile blackmail specialists operating for the state of Israel. And Trump also has a history with Jeffrey Epstein. Top people in the United States, many of them are blackmailed in various ways by various agencies, and the Israelis are massively overrepresented in that. Just for one example, when J. Edgar Hoover had blackmail pictures on everybody in the country, Meyer Lansky had blackmail pictures on Hoover. And so who ran the country? It was Meyer Lansky. Who's Meyer Lansky? He's Israel's man in organized crime and the number one organized crime figure in the world. So there's been this gradual increase in Zionist power in all of these areas, including the deep state and organized crime, including buying up Congress critters, murdering presidents that are a threat to Israel, like JFK, and installing Israeli agents like Johnson. And this process has been going on more and more and more. And then finally, with 9/11, we get the final Zionist coup d'etat in America. If they can do that to us and we have to shut up about it, it's pretty much all she wrote.
Yeah, that was, I think it was Phil Giraldi who was talking about the American ambassador to Israel when they reporters started asking questions about the massacre that occurred last spring there, about the protesters, Israelis massacred those protesters. He told them to shut up.
It's like, yeah.
What? That's what the Fourth Estate's for, I guess. Just shut up. Uncomfortable questions. This idea of, I guess, the dominance, the prominence they have both in the financial community, entertainment culture, politics, the judiciary, these things. It's been it's been attributed to, I guess, their intelligence, their ability, talent, higher IQ. Some say these things. I mean, I'm not going to deny them that, you know, there's a lot of talented, smart Jews out there, as there are a lot of talented other people. But yeah, they tend to be overrepresented, you know, less than 2% of the population. I think they make up 45% of the federal judiciary or something like that. James Petras wrote an article about this, and he was talking about, well, okay, they come from the most elite institutions. He's talking to people like, Benjamin Bernanke, Janet Yellen, Alan Greenspan, and other people like, you know, in the foreign policy arena, like Paul Wolfowitz. They all come from these elite institutions, whether it's Harvard, Yale, and these things. And they graduate summa cum laude, and they're the brightest guys in the room, brightest kids in the classroom, so to speak. Well, then when they're in office and they're installed in power, their policies should be good policy because they're the smartest people in the room, right? Well, all their policies are disastrous. Whether it's, you know, Ben Bernanke and Greenspan and yelling at the Fed, you know, they, you know, collapsing the dollar, rapid inflation, blowing bubbles everywhere, and these things. He talks about, you know, people like Wolfowitz at the Department of Defense, and he says, well, obviously it isn't merit here. We're looking at policy. But then in the article, bear with me. He says, why is this so? And he goes, After examining the performance of top officials in foreign policy, we find that their assumptions, often blatant manipulations and misrepresentations about Iraq, were completely wrong. The pursuit of war was disastrous and criminal. Their occupation blueprint led to prolonged conflict and the rise of terrorism. Their pretext for war was a fabrication derived from those close to ties with the Israeli intelligence in opposition to the findings of U.S. intelligence. Their sanctions policy toward Iran has cost U.S. economy many billions, while their pro-Israeli policy cost the U.S. Treasury and taxpayers over $110 billion over the last 30 years. Let me fast forward here a little. The gulf between the academic credentials and the actual performance extends to the economic policy. Neoliberal policies favoring Wall Street speculators were adopted by such strategic policymakers as Alan Greenspan, Ben Bernanke, and Lawrence Summers. Their leadership rendered the country vulnerable to the biggest economic crash since the Great Depression, with millions of Americans losing employment and homes. Now, let me just fast forward if I have this highlighted properly here. If economic performance were to be measured in terms of sustained growth, balanced budget, reductions in inequalities, and creation of stable, well-paying jobs, the economic elite, despite their self-promoted merits, have been absolute failures. However, if we adopt an alternative criteria for success, their performance looks pretty impressive. They've bailed out their banking colleagues, implemented destructive free trade agreements, and opened up overseas investments opportunities for higher rates of profits that might be made from investing in the domestic economy. If you evaluate foreign policy performance in terms of U.S. political, economic, and military interests, their policies have been costly in lives, financial losses, and military defeats for the nation as a whole. They rate summa cum laude. However, if we consider their foreign policies in the alternative terms of Israel's political, economic, and military interests, they regain their summa cum laudes. They have all been well rewarded for their services. The war against Iraq destroyed an opponent of Israel's economic cleansing of Palestine. The systematic destruction of Iraqi civil society and state has eliminated any possibility of Iraq recovering as a modern, secular, multi-ethnic, multi-confessional state. Here, Israel made a major advance toward unopposed regional military dominance without losing a soldier or spending a shekel. The Iran sanctions authored and pushed by Levy and Cohen served to undermine another regional foe of Israel and land grabs in the West Bank, even if it cost U.S. hundreds of billions of lost profits in markets and investments. By resetting the criteria for these officials, it's clear that their true academic merit correlates with their success policies on behalf of the state of Israel, regardless of how mediocre the performance have been for the United States and its state and nation and people. So, sorry for the long quote, but I thought it was worthwhile citing it because we have an example. We do know that Israelis, they claim this loyalty or concern for Israel. But at the same time, they're Americans, whether it's in Hollywood or at the State Department or Department of Defense. You have this problem of dual loyalty. I've always said, well, in many cases, dual loyalty would be an improvement. but the idea of CNN, they're agents of Israel, everywhere they go is Israel. So they have this loyalty to Israel. Isn't this a problem? And even Phil Giraldi broached this issue. With any Jew in power, is going to have there's going to be legitimate suspicion regarding his loyalties and motivations, without being an anti-Semitic or right? I mean, am I wrong in that or?
No, you're totally right. I mean, that quote was right on the money. And Jewish Americans should be joining people like Alan Zabrowski and Jeremy Rothkuschel and others who are calling this out and standing up for America, not for Israel. Because even Jewish Americans who are self-interested and who would like to prevent a rise of anti-Jewish feeling should be interested in this, because it's true. It's, we've really been abused since 9/11. In 2008, that financial crash, it wasn't just a kind of innocent mistake that just happened to be good for the rich and so on. It was very much orchestrated, and I believe the actual the decision or the trigger for the crash actually happened on the morning of September 11th, 2008. And we're not getting the full story probably from the folks who've done the autopsy of that crash, but it's really clear that a vast amount of money was vacuumed up, that it was an orchestrated deal. It wasn't just that these lenders just happened to, for no particular reason, give out all these bad loans and then sell the bad paper. It was not innocent. I mean, of course they knew what they were doing. It was a group of people that sat down and figured out it, just like with the SNL scandal back around 1990 or whenever it was, that there was a way to bilk vast piles of money out of the system. And that's what they did. So, yeah, it's true that, that this is a huge problem, and that really the most powerful people who happen to have Jewish ethnicity, when we look at foreign policy, when we look at economic policy, their policies do seem to be benefiting either their class, not, you know, not certainly working class Jewish people, but the wealthy people of all ethnicities. And with regard to foreign policy, obviously Israel has profited massively from these disastrous wars post 9/11, and nobody else has. And this was all predictable. 9/11 itself could not possibly have benefited anyone but Israel. And then when we look at how Israel actually prepared for it, they put all their chips, they pulled all their chips out of everything else and put them into security and anti-terror startups. The beginning of 2001. And Naomi Klein talks about this in the Shock Doctrine. And that saved their economy, which was about to, you know, go down the toilet at that point. And, you know, they were also fighting an intifada that was scaring people out of Israel. Everybody was getting second passports and trying to, you know, get a way out because it looked like Israel was kaput. And then 9/11 came along, and suddenly the financial crunch was over, and suddenly they could use the massive force to crush the Palestinian resistance. So, yeah, that's absolutely correct. You know, we really have had a coup d'etat here. 9/11 was kind of the final blow in a series of coups that built up to it. And so now we do have the tail wagging the dog. And we're not supposed to talk about it. But again, I emphasize that the people who are operating out of bigotry and prejudice are the people who are, for emotional, visceral reasons, telling us that we shouldn't talk about these things. And if they really don't think that we're right, they should be willing to dispassionately debate us, but they're not willing to, because they know that we're right and they just need to silence us. And that's what they're doing. That's one of the biggest reasons for the wave of internet censorship that we're seeing now.
Yeah. It's ADL coordinating with YouTube and Google. And even if you notice that your search terms now bring up different responses than they did a few years ago, and they've changed the algorithm to make it much more difficult to do even research on the internet. That's a long history. I mean, the ADL, I was reading about the American First Committee back in 1941, where the ADL worked with the FBI to spy on members of the American First Committee. These were just, you know, patriotic Americans who opposed FDR's drive to war. And so, but that, even as far back as 1941, the ADL was working with the FBI to shut down America's, you know, loyal Americans' right to free speech, and also political activism to have a, you know, to offer alternative view to critique the government policy.
Well, Charles Lindbergh, who was the biggest hero and celebrity of his era, was permanently smeared and you know, pushed down the list.
Despite of what he said was true, he gave the speech.
What he said was he said it's the British and the Jews who are pushing us into this war.
Yeah.
And of course, nobody went after him for Anglophobia. although there probably was at least as much Anglophobia as there was Judeophobia in America at the time. People really didn't like the British that much, especially after the British welched on their loans for World War I.
Yes.
But when Lindbergh said it's the Brits and the Jews pushing us into this war, which was true, that was used to smear him as a supposed Judeophobe, or in their terms, anti-Semite, and that pretty much destroyed his reputation unjustly.
And even if you make an accusation, even if it's true, it doesn't protect you from being smeared. And in fact, after the war, Jewish organizations bragged about being influential in dragging Americans into the war to win the war against Hitler. It had to be done, supposedly. So he was right when he gave that speech on September 11th, 1941 in Des Moines, Iowa, about America being dragged into the war. But it's interesting, because maybe, we're coming up on an hour now, and so you have an hour to take that broader picture, because we mentioned, so the British intrigues, in the first part of the 20th century regarding both world wars, although there's a Jewish backdrop to that too. This idea of the United States always being sort of suborned or influenced by foreign powers because of its potential latent and actual power. And, of course, once it becomes an empire, it's always going to be influenced by foreign powers because so much is at stake in using its power. You know, a good example, you know, before, you know, between World War I and World War II, a lot of people in Middle America were skeptical of British influence. And this idea of a foreign power, fifth columnist, you know, coming in and using their influence, intrigue, and all type of chicanery to undermine, you know, representative government of the United States. This isn't anything new. It isn't just Jewish. But in this case, we are talking about an Israeli state and these things. So as a broader picture, yes, this happens. Foreign influence. That's where there's law. We have laws supposed to protect us from these things.
Right. And today, of course, they're diverting us with Russiagate, telling us the problem is Russia. But there are even some mainstream figures who've admitted that obviously Israel meddles in American politics and elections vastly more than Russia ever has even dreamed of. And the media never even mentions it.
And of course, that America meddles in elections all over the world.
That's right. Yeah, we're the number one election meddlers.
And when we can't control an election, we stage a coup.
So, John Perkins goes into that in Confessions of Economic Hitman, how that works.
I mean, I can just see how Iranians listen to reports that Americans worried about, foreign meddling in their elections, and if they have any idea of their recent history, not so past.
Right. They're also not impressed with our so-called war on terrorism. We just sent in a bunch of goons to blow up some innocent Iranians. I'm sure you heard about that mm-hmm. recent attack in Iran.
Well, MEK, right? And those groups that we...
Yeah, the MEK is the leading one, but apparently they're claiming that... I think Bolton invented some new front group for... But they're all just mercenaries, paid mercenaries that do this stuff.
As are most of the Islamist groups that are out there. They're proxies for Western imperialism to destabilize this region. I mean, that history is there. It's the Mujahideen turns into Al-Qaeda, turns into ISIS. They just changed the brand name. They import them into the Caucasus in the 90s or the Balkans to destabilize those regions, so I mean, really, at this point I'm like, please. I mean, so, well, yeah. Anything else? I mean, you said you had you here for an hour. Do you think we covered it, or any points you want to make?
Yeah, I think we've done pretty well for 1 hour. Maybe we could do another show down the line.
Oh, certainly, I'd love to do that. So that Dr. Kevin Barrett, and sorry, that book is from Yahweh to.
From Yahweh to Zion. Yeah, it's by Laurent Guyonneau.
And you translated it?
Yeah, I translated it and published it earlier in the year.
Okay, from Yahweh to Zion. And of course, your show is Truth Jihad Radio.
That's right. And the website is truthjihad.com.
Is that a weekly show or daily?
I put out averages 5 hours of radio a week, and plus I do false flag weekly news for an hour every Friday.
So as it breaks down news, that's almost a daily show. And of course, then you're False Flag Weekly with Jeremy Rothkuchel, correct?
Yeah, Jeremy's been the main guy recently, although Tony Hall is now coming back too. So we're juggling things a little bit. We're bringing on an occasional guest host. So right now, the key core there is me, Tony Hall, and Jeremy Rothkuchel.
And Tony Hall was the professor in Lethbridge University. He almost lost his job because...
Yeah, it looks like he's being forced into retirement.
Jeez. And that was because of that Facebook false flag, right? Wasn't there like...
Yeah. They planted a horrific kill all Jews image on his Facebook page, unbeknownst to him, and then put out press releases blaming him for it. And of course, the media went along with it.
Yeah, usually when you see something like that posted, it's usually a Jewish organization that's arranged for it, because they want the press, the publicity.
Yeah, well, it turns out this image was created by Joshua Goldstein, who was actually arrested for false flag Islamic terrorism.
Well, there's a long tradition, Israeli tradition of that, isn't there?
So, oh, yeah.
Okay, well, Doctor, thank you so much. It was a great talk.
Okay.
I enjoyed it.
I really enjoyed it.
I'm going to post this soon. When I do, I'll send you the link. And, yeah, we'll get together maybe... a few weeks or months and months ahead, and we'll talk about something else.
Sounds good.
Great. You have a good night then.
Okay, you too.
Bye bye.
Bye.
One of the early ones I didn't sing. Well, you and I travel to the beat of a different drum. Can't you tell by the way I run? Every time you make eyes at me, you cry, you moan, you say, it'll work out.
But honey child, I got my doubts. You can't see the forest for the trees. And don't get me wrong, it's not that I knock it, it's just that I'm not in the market for a girl who wants to love only me. And I'm not saying that you're not pretty. No, all's I'm saying's I'm not ready for any person, place, or thing to try and pull the reins in on me. Well, I feel pretty sure you'll find you a man who'll take a lot more than I ever could or can, and you'll settle down with him, and I know that you'll be happy. So goodbye, I'm leaving. I see no sense in you crying and grieving. We'll both live a lot longer if you live without me. If you live without me. Oh, if you live without me. With apologies and special thanks to Linda, and a fond good night to y'all.